Hey everyone, welcome to the Delta Flyers with Tom and Harry as we journey through episodes of Star Trek Voyager. Your two hosts along this journey are my fellow Trek actor, who also directed the third episode of the series, So Help Me Todd, Mr. Robert Duncan McNeil, and myself, your favorite Eternal Ensign, Garrett Wong. Remember, you can get the full version of this podcast by signing up to become a patron at patreon.com/Delta Flyers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Robbie McNeil.
Hey, buddy. Hey, you're getting very current with the credits now. What are you doing right now? Well, that'll be your credit.
At some point, I'm going to run out of stuff to say.
I know.
So I'm going to be saying, my fellow actor and the man who ate Eggs Benedict for breakfast today is what I'm going to throw in there.
Exactly.
That's how current it's going to be.
It's going to get really current. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Speaking of current, did you see someone on Twitter adapted a poster?
Oh no. Yes, I saw.
You saw, and they made a Captain Proton poster, but what was the original poster?
I'm the original poster was for the TV series Buck Rogers.
The
one that starred my good buddy Gil Gerard, who's always at Dragon Con every year with me. He comes and judges the Miss Star Trek Universe pageant for me. So shout out to Gil Gerard. But that's the original poster. It's Buck.
Photoshopped it, adapted it into a Captain Proton.
Yes.
With me as Gil Gerard,
as Buck Rogers, is Gil Gerard's body, and
yes,
me as Wilma Deering, his.
I looked at it for a second. I was like, what is going on there? And then I realized, oh, you have a woman's body.
I do.
And a head of Harry Kim.
Of Harry Kim. So Harry Kim's
or
head.
Buster
is,
Kincaid. Really.
Or Buster, yes. So Buster Kincaid is quite shapely.
Yes, he really
compared
is.
To the regular Buster Kincaid.
I really need that poster.
It's and even funnier is Jerry Ryan's head, Seven of Nine's head, yeah, is on Twiggy, the robot. So
yes,
this little tiny robot named Twiggy is it's very, very funny. So.
She's very funny. And then Janeway is like some showgirl, Vegas showgirl. Did you see Janeway?
Yes, that's who she was.
Who is,
okay.
I don't know what that's from.
Yeah, I think that's from...
It's not even from the original poster, I don't think.
It might be. It might be.
Really?
I think that might have been Ming the Merciless's daughter, his princess, maybe in one of her outfits. Possibly.
Yeah.
So it's still very funny. I know you were tickled pink by it. So
I thought it was amazing. I'm like, I need this in my home theater. I need this somewhere.
Oh my gosh.
Because it just makes me laugh.
Yeah, it's very funny. So yeah,
and
just
it's
check
very
on Twitter.
Well done.
It's the Photoshop job that was done on that poster. It was a good job. I'm impressed.
Yeah,
I'm impressed. For me, right before I logged on, Megan was showing me a video on YouTube of the Foo Fighters were performing their hit song "My Hero," but at drummer instead of their drummer passed away, Taylor Hawkins, it was Taylor Hawkins' son, Shane Hawkins.
I saw
this video.
Oh yeah, it's very powerful.
It's so powerful. I mean, I'm about to start crying again. I gotta get out of that phase. I mean, but this has been a month. This month has been a month of tears, but tears of just, you know, moving things like that, seeing the son with all the emotion that he had drumming. And if you guys haven't seen that video, go on YouTube and look at that. And then for me at Dragon Con, just all these panels with you know, tears were shed by Wilson Cruz. They were Blue Del Barrio from Discovery, Jess Bush from Strange New Worlds. Everyone had some type of story where there was some emotionality, some heavy emotions attached to it. And every time any of the actors started crying, me being the host and being so sensitive and emotional, I started crying immediately right after that. So it was a tear fest pretty much. This entire month.
That sounds powerful.
Yeah, powerful. And not in a bad way. It was all, you know, it was a good way. It was transformational kind of stuff. Like, this was the deepest of all the conversations I've ever had at Dragon Con.
Wow.
So, intense, really intense. But, Yeah. So you've had an intense experience seeing a poster which tickled your funny bone.
Yes, that was very intense. I laughed. I cried. The poster just brought on the full experience of emotions.
Is the artist going to make a full size real poster and send it to you? Have they said that yet?
Okay. I begged for it on Twitter. Okay. I did. We'll see.
Yeah. Go to Twitter and you can see me or Harry Kim with boobs, basically.
Yes. Okay. All right. So what is our episode this week?
One small step. So let us go watch One Small Step, and we will be right back. For Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material. All right, Robbie and I are back from watching One Small Step, and we also have writer extraordinaire Mr. Brian Fuller with us to talk about this episode. Yes, thank you for being here once
again.
Thank
you, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
For those of you who are listening and not viewing, Brian has on his The Delta Flyers merch shirt. It's the one with all the episodes on the back, forming the Star Trek chevron. And there, yeah, look at that. Brian's modeling it for us right now.
It really is. Mm-hmm. Fabulous model.
Yeah. And Brian, it is a comfortable shirt, isn't it, sir?
It's so cozy and soft. It goes right on. And flyers right above my nipple. So when I'm underlying
right.
a flyer, I'm stroking my nipple.
Oh, exactly.
Oh, that's why we did it that way. It's all part of our plan.
That was our plan.
Yes, okay. Multifunctional shirts can accomplish all sorts of things.
Experience.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
All right, let's begin every episode like we normally do, Robbie. Let's start with our poetry synopsis of this episode, One Small Step, and I will begin with my haiku.
Please,
you will follow with your limerick. So, yes, here we go, Brian. You ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Here's my haiku of One Small Step. Graviton ellipse. It devoured Aries 4, the Yankees in 6.
Oh.
Ooh. Thank you. Thank you.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. As we've discussed, the haiku, because we've traded these before.
We have.
The haiku doesn't have to rhyme. You just got to fit in a certain number of syllables.
Yes.
I'm going to say it's a slightly easier version than the limerick.
It's easier, but it's also difficult because in the haiku, you really have to boil it down to the essence. I mean, you have to think what's going to fit in here and still give you the episode, right?
The haiku actually is more effective for capturing the synopsis.
The synopsis, true.
The limerick is more effective for trying to be clever.
Yes.
So with that said, here we go. My limerick for One Small Step.
Yeah.
A spatial anomaly may be our apocalypse until Seven sees some old NASA clips. John Kelly is an inspiration, but my main observation is stay away from a graviton ellipse.
Nice. Woo. Look at that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well done.
Yeah. It doesn't really tell you much about the episode, but.
Or does it?
Or does it?
Or does it? Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Let's talk about guest stars and writers and directors and everything right now.
Let's talk about writers since we have our writer here. We have four writers. We do. Mike Voliger, Jessica Scott, Brian Fuller, and Michael Taylor. Brian, how did that happen that you get four writers?
This story idea came in as this was a freelance assignment. For the slot. And we did a couple of those a season where it was trying to get new writers in, exposed to the environment and throw them a bone. The Raven was my freelance on Voyager. And it's usually like a ticket to get into the writing staff. And in this instance, it's such a hard thing to do a spec script or a freelance script rather for a show because it's in situ, you're joining, everybody knows the characters and the situations much better than you. There were certain situations with this script as it evolved that the writers did a couple of drafts and then Mike and I jumped in to do a rewrite of it. It was a pretty extensive rewrite and there were things about the first draft that just felt like kind of green. I remember there was one point where two characters were described in like this tense situation, and they gave each other a knowing look, and then that was the act out of the scene. And we were like, oh, they're not quite yet versed in how to wrap up a scene, and right. and we're doing it in a way where they're like, I think this is what you do. But that always like struck me as one of those lessons to be learned in a situation when you're writing a freelance script for somebody about what qualifies as an act out and what doesn't. And it's hard to know what on the page is going to work in an act out. So Mike and Jessica did a really solid draft. And then Mike Taylor were given the task of rewriting, and I've done a few things with Mike Taylor and love working with him. So this was another ball. It was very nostalgia-esque, you know, for us, like Bride of Chaotica. There was something about the nostalgia of the crew that was exciting about this one, but it was much more kind of historical excitement as opposed to pop culture excitement.
Yeah.
Which I think was the impetus to give Chakotay the storyline, when you might think that it would naturally go to Tom Paris because of history. But that kind of fine line that we discussed was, you know, Tom is a purveyor of pop culture, and this was actually historical for Chakotay.
Yeah.
I think knowing what I know now about structuring characters and supporting characters, there was a very blurred line between what one character would be interested in as opposed to another. And they're so individually specified to give a greater kind of protagonist journey in a script. That looking back now and thinking like, wow, everybody besides Chakotay would be as obsessive, but Chakotay was the one whose decision making was kind of compromised by his passion in this story. So there's a lot of things looking back at the episode where I'm like, does that track? Did it track for you, gentlemen?
It did. It did for me. It tracked very well. I thought Chakotay's journey and Seven of Nine's journey was a very interesting sort of counterpoint, those two. Just to jump back, so this was a spec script. Was this script originally a Tom Paris? Did they write it as a Tom Paris?
I'm trying to remember the first drafts, and it evolved. Like I believe that Chakotay became the, you know, sort of passion flag for the Aries and the history of the Aries.
I think it's great. I mean, I don't, it's not like, oh God, why didn't I get an episode or something? It's not that at all. I actually think it's really great that it's Chakotay, because you could speak to this better than I, but I felt like often Chakotay was left without story and without specificity. And this was really great to see him on something, you know, a character journey where I understood the passion, that the weight of his passion made sense to me. A lot of times our characters were given sort of these journeys motivated by something, especially Tom Paris first couple seasons, that was so shallow and that was just, why is that the thing that they're passionate about? This for Chakotay was great. And I love it. Knowing that it was a spec script. And my second question is, normally, a script evolves from a story pitch, and then the room breaks the story. So you've got all the writers figuring out scene by scene how it's going to go. Then you've got your outline document, and then you write. So it's kind of, there's a group development process often. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, and this was the same. I misspoke when I said spec script and intended to say freelance script. So got it. So Mike and Jessica did come into the writer's room. They did break it with us.
I see. Okay.
And we did the whole process. And it was one of those that the storyline was so clear and about the, you know, finding a piece of home so far away from home and what that means. That was something that we returned a lot to in Voyager throughout the years. We frequently did episodes where we found a bit of home in the Delta Quadrant, whether that was, you know, a Klingon ship or distant origin with the dinosaur people who went out to discover the galaxy. That was a theme that kept recurring in Voyager that I enjoyed, but it is like space is big and we keep running across all of these things. Like, oh, you dropped this. So that came out of another one of those ideas that was above the fray, because yeah. that was a lot of the pitches that we got as some piece of home that we found in the Delta Quadrant. And this one felt like it was going to the heart of exploration and the thematics of what Starfleet represents in a way that was clearer. And so Jessica and Mike pitched the story, then got to go along the process of coming to the room, breaking it, doing the outline, doing a first draft of the script, doing a second draft of the script. And then that's when Mike and I jumped in to polish. So I would say most of the dialogue in there is probably Mike and I's, including like, Arrakis and those types of references. I was always throwing in references to other science fiction or pop culture, whether it's Battlestar Galactica or Dune. Or what have you.
Okay. When it listed the teleplay credits, it's interesting that you see it says Mike Wallager and it's the ampersand, the and symbol, and Jessica Scott. And then it's A-N-D spelled out. It says Brian Fuller, another ampersand, Michael Taylor. So it's formatted in a very unique way, too. Like it usually would just say Mike Wallager and Jessica Scott and Brian Fuller and Michael Taylor. But there's the ampersand that separates Mike and Jessica, and the ampersand between you and Michael. Is that on purpose, because that you guys did a lot of the actual teleplay or the rewrite, and so they separated you? I don't know why they used the ampersand and the A-N-D.
Well, it's all WGA sort of clarification. So if it's an ampersand, it's a team. So Jessica and Mike wrote it as a team.
Copy.
And then the A-N-D is basically to indicate that we did not work simultaneously.
Got you. Okay.
So Mike and Jessica did their drafts, mm-hmm. and then Mike and I did our drafts.
Okay.
We weren't sort of like changing scenes around and working as a unit. The ampersand means team.
Okay. So it's a writer's guild. It's a union thing for you guys. Okay. Understood.
Speaking of unions, the DGA comes next here, and I see Robert Picardo. Robert Picardo directed this. What are your memories of Bob directing on this, his second episode ever?
I think he did a great job.
Agreed.
On the episode. And we've all worked with Bob. We all love Bob. And I think the thing that is distinctive about Bob is that he is in it to win it and very passionate and wants to do a great job. So of course that is usually, and you know this better than anybody, Robbie, in television directing, there's a certain sense of show up, do the job, and then kind of like ghost in, ghost out, and move along home, where Bob was already home. And so his passions were, and for the development process and questions over the course of the development of the script, were always omnipresent. So he didn't have to move along home because he was already there. And I just remember him being very passionate and
agreed. I do too.
Ubiquitous in the heart building during this process, because he wanted to make sure that he was getting it right and showing up and asking questions and cornering the right people in the hallways and just continuing to make sure that he was leaving no stone unturned. And that was delightful, because it was kind of be careful what you wish for in terms of the producers on the show, because they're like, just go do the job. And Bob was like, I want to talk about it. And of course, for me as a staff writer, I'm like, I want to talk about it all day too. So it was delightful for me. But I think for some of the higher up producers, they were like, maybe collect your questions altogether. and then approach.
I was telling Garrett, I remember that zero gravity stuff. He was very concerned about the technicalities of it. And I remember him once coming in my trailer or asking me to step in, and we sat and we kind of broke down like transitions and shots in all of that stuff, because he was passionate, absolutely at the core of it. But there was nerves.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about the anti-gravity stuff and how challenging that is, it's, you know, experience and just having the hours logged goes such a long way in being able to solve those problems economically. Like I remember, you know, there was some anti-grav stuff in Prey, and Tim was, I think that might've been David Livingston who directed Prey, but I'm not sure. It was somebody who was a much more experienced director. And for this, instead of doing this big elaborate gimbal or wires or anything like this, the director and Tim, and I think it was Tim, was like, why don't you put an Apple box there and I'll just slowly step up onto it and do the special effect with the performance. So there was a collaboration and a problem solving there that I think you only get when you have a lot of experience, where it's like, oh, the camera is only going to be seeing this frame. So everything outside of that frame is inconsequential. As long as we can deliver anti-gravity within this frame, we don't need wires and we don't need a gimbal. We're just going to have Tim Russ step elegantly on top of an apple box and look like he's floating. And that probably would have helped Bob have an easier time if you know, he had that kind of buttressing and shepherding in the process, because I think oftentimes directors and television are just thrown to the wolves.
Yeah. That was Alan Eastman, by the way.
Was it Alan Eastman?
Yes.
Did a great job. I love that.
Yes. All right. Absolutely.
Guest star, Phil Morris. I know him more from more comedic job that he's done, but he is a really stand-up guy, and I'm glad that he was cast in this role. I actually saw him at Star Trek Las Vegas. He was at that convention this year.
And he's been in a lot of Star Trek. He's played humans and Klingons and Jem'Hadar, and he was in the original series as a child.
He was in the original series as a child?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, God. Well,
if we talk about a long resume, look at that guy's resume.
Okay, so I somehow forgot to get his first job.
That's okay.
As my one homework assignment.
I'm wondering if the original TOS.
That's what I'm about to tell. That's what I'm about to tell you. That is his first job.
Oh, that is it.
I just looked it up.
It's Mary, the one with all the kids.
Yes, so Mary. He plays one of the boys. He's got it says he's the army helmet boy. But that's
if there's ever a guest star that we need to have on this podcast, it's the one whose first job was Star Trek as a kid. You have to agree. This is quite apropos.
I cannot believe that. Yeah. He's also been in over 250 TV shows.
That's what I'm saying. That's a huge resume.
He was in Search for Spock, Star Trek III.
Yeah.
He's been on daytime soaps. He's done a million different things. It's really unbelievable as I look at this.
Hey, you know what? He still looks the same too. He looks great. Phil looks great right now.
And one of the things that I love about actors like Phil Morris is that they're so handsome, yet strength is comedy. And there's something about comedic actors who are so facile between extremities of tone that do so well on Star Trek, whether they're playing Jem'Hadars or Klingons or a human being. And all of those are different styles of performances. But it's so amusing that someone so handsome gets how to use their handsomeness as a comedic tool.
Talented guy. All right, let's jump right into this, Robbie. I mean, we start out with an exterior planet shot. We know the date, October 19th, 2032. It's Mars. We have an exterior space shot of the Ares IV. And now we go into the interior of the Ares IV, and Phil Morris is talking to his ground crew, and he's talking about how the Yankees have just won Game 5. And then he says, well, there's one more game left. But now here's my question. Then they start talking about how Houston ground control has too many Kings fans. And I'm going, now, wait a minute. The Kings are in basketball, the Sacramento Kings, and they're also in hockey, the Los Angeles Kings. But they are not in baseball. So was this a writer thing, thinking that there would be an expansion of the baseball league to include a team called the Kings? Or was this just a snafu on the part of the writers in terms of you guys kind of threw in the wrong thing? I don't know.
If it was sports related, chances are I didn't write it.
Okay.
Like, so, and there's some,
was this Michael Taylor who wrote that then, maybe?
Yes, and I would imagine with Mike Taylor that he probably extrapolated some sort of, you know, expansion. Or the King's title and thought okay. about that, knowing okay. Michael Taylor.
All
but
right.
anything in any of these scripts that is any sort of like sports reference, I can guarantee I had nothing to
do with it. That you had nothing to do with it. But Robbie, did you... when you were watching,
I didn't catch that.
You did, oh,
well, I think a huge my baseball mind, fan, so. My mind went to exactly what I think the intention was, which was they were talking about fake future players and fake future teams. That so I think it just
okay.
it blew past.
So me. It went past you.
The all thing right. I noticed in this right away was the way Bob shot this. Even though John Kelly, the astronaut, was strapped into his seat, the camera movement was twisting and floating mm-hmm. and very. Lyrical and definitely different than the artificial gravity that we experience on Voyager, where everything is just like there is gravity in this, historical NASA ship. There's not. So that shot making I thought was really well done.
Yeah.
I remember Bob talking about that, about talking about the point of view of the camera being subject to the lack of gravity since everybody else was strapped in. So to sell gravity, he had to do it with the camera. So I remember mm-hmm. him thinking about those things mm-hmm. in the production meetings.
Yeah. It was very effective.
It was. It worked. Definitely. Phil detects an anomaly heading right for him. And that is pretty much the straight to commercial with the, I loved it. You see the reflection eyes. Of the, yes, yes, of the anomaly in his eyes. It was beautiful.
Do you remember, was that something that was scripted or was that a conversation that was scripted? Yeah. A lot of times, you know, things like that, as we do our podcast, I don't know if it's the director choice or if you guys, you know, wrote in the moment, but that felt like a very intentional moment for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was in the script.
Great. We go to Chakotay's quarters next. He's reading a book, mm-hmm. drinking some Akuchi Moya tea, I think. And the doorbell chimes. And he says,
chimes.
He's like, come in. Doesn't open. Come in. Ding dongs again. Rings a few more times. He gets up. Nobody's there. But he tries to call the bridge. He gets the transporter room captain, which I assume is a loop group person. Yeah. It was a voice I didn't recognize. Right. So I was like, okay, the transporter engineer says, sorry, this transporter room. Chakotay says, can you patch me into the bridge or reroute my call? And then he gets all this interference. We hear Neelix. The only appearance of Neelix in the episode, by the way.
What?
I think so. I did not recall seeing Neelix in the episode.
He's never on screen. We hear his voice and that's it.
Tell me if you saw him. I don't remember seeing him.
I feel okay. Well, we'll keep going. We'll
but you hear him here. Yeah, you do hear him. You hear the bridge. You hear the mess hall. Yes. You know,
we hear a whole cacophony of voices and sounds. Right?
Yes. And at the very end, Chakotay's like, okay, I'm out of here. He tries to go out the door. It doesn't open. He turns and walks away, and then it opens. It's a great comical beat with him heading to the door. It keeps shutting on him. He walks away. It opens. And then finally, he jumps through. And gets out of his quarters. So everything's a mess.
I wonder if Bob embellished that last moment, that beat.
It feels like a Bob bit.
Yeah, it does. It feels like this is what Bob would suggest. Like, I'm going to have him go through and then go back and go through and then go back and then finally get out. You know, maybe that
it's
could have been
a classic comedy vaudeville bit. It's good.
Yeah.
It was good. And it's fun to see Chakotay doing these lighter moments.
Yes.
That it physical really comedy is. Beat really was really is. Refreshing. For
I
him.
Agree. I agree. All right, engineering. Chakotay comes in and approaches Seven. Obviously, he already knows that Seven's been tinkering with this because he says that he sees that she's making some changes, but he's not really at her station yet. So I'm assuming that he already knows that she's been tinkering with this. She's been making some changes to the computer core. She says she's enhanced the command sequencers with Borg algorithms. And Chakotay says it is wreaking havoc with the secondary systems. He didn't authorize these changes. But then she starts telling us that she's been trying to tell B'Elanna that these changes would help. And B'Elanna's been not paying attention to her. So she just wanted to show her.
Just
so now we have
a demonstration would be better. I'll just do it anyway.
A bit of a maverick here. And not, you know, I thought that she would have already learned her lesson not to do things without permission or without someone at least approving it. But not in this case.
7 to 9 is the honey badger.
She is the honey badger. Yes, you're right.
Seven has a little comedy here. She says clearly, she tells Chakotay, clearly Voyager is not ready for assimilation.
Yes.
Silence. She goes, that was a joke.
And then she says to comedy, the doctor tells me that I need to come up with some comedy to diffuse tense situations.
Yes, I need to use humor. Do you remember the kind of runner? That was a runner that went on, because later on Chakotay's got his thing.
Yeah.
Who wrote the comedy in these scripts?
Yeah, who's Brian? Yeah, Brian.
It was probably Mike and I. We wrote separately, and we did a lot of writing together. On Bride of Chaotica, I think we stood in the same room and wrote that. And I think this was one where we did a lot of writing together, and we also did some separate writing. But the comedy stuff was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it was also, you know, trying to find that balance between Seven of Nine stoicism and her humor. And I thought it was something that Jerry navigated really, really well.
Yeah.
But it was also, I think comedy on Star Trek is a complicated needle to thread.
It is.
Tonally, it's not supported anyplace else. Mm-hmm. And it sort of seems out of character, so you really need actors who are facile with that level of tone shift, and I think, you know, Bob certainly is, Ethan certainly is, you both are, and Jerry surprisingly is as well.
At least with Star Trek there was an opportunity to include it in our tone, but you had to be careful. You're right, it was a very small needle to thread there.
Yeah. All right. So Chakotay asks her to get the secondary systems back up again. Then all of a sudden we have a ship-wide power drain, a big ship shake, and Harry's voice in the comm calling all senior officers to the bridge. We enter the bridge and we see Harry is in the command chair. Yay. Yeah. Janeway and Tuvok enter. Tuvok relieves Ayala from tactical, and Kim is relieved of the big chair by Janeway. And Janeway sort of, I don't know if she scolds him. She sort of, you know, she says, it's two in the morning. This better be good. She's a little
better be
she's
grumpy.
She's grumpy. She hasn't had her coffee, clearly. There's no coffee inside of Janeway. So that's why she's grumpy. Harry tells Janeway that we have a level 9 gravimetric distortion coming at us from subspace. It's closing in on our positions. Janeway says, shields up, evasive maneuvers. Chakotay and Seven now appear on the bridge. Paris says, we cannot outrun them at impulse. Janeway orders us to go to warp, and the anomaly, which reads as 30 million terajoules of subspace energy, disrupts our warp field. Seven recognizes the phenomenon as a spatial anomaly known as 521 to the Borg, and it is attracted to objects that emit electromagnetic energy. She says, we better cut power to reverse our shield polarity, and it works.
Isn't it also attracted to dark matter? Like this?
We don't know that yet.
Not yet. Oh, we haven't got to that yet.
Yeah, that comes up later.
Yep.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
I did a Twitter bomb. Like, hey.
And I wish.
And you shut me down, and now I'm deleting my tweet.
I want to say, in this scene, I thought Bob did a great job of carving out character in here. Like when Seven of Nine, he sees the anomaly, and she says, this was the Borg designated this spatial anomaly 521. There's this like push into a real tight close up as she's just looking at it before she names it. And so you see that this is landing with some stakes for Seven, that this thing is a scary thing to her. She knows because of the Borg what this is. So it sets up her whole point of view through the episode. And I think if Bob had not filmed it in that way, if he had just cut to a medium shot of Seven saying this, it wouldn't have landed as with the weight that you needed to carry Seven of Nine's point of view through the whole episode, that she has a different outlook on this thing than everybody else. So right. I thought that detail was great.
Yeah.
And I think those points are really salient in terms of translating story, because otherwise the conflict later with Seven of Nine and Chakotay would be meaningless if you're not setting up that she thinks this thing is dangerous and should be destroyed, so it stops, you know, capturing ships and pulling things into subspace. And that juxtaposed with Chakotay's desire to solve it or to get inside it sets up the whole dramatic conflict of the episode.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think, again, Bob's attention to detail was really, really strong here.
Yeah. After we avoid the ellipse from taking us over, Janeway then realizes that she also recognizes this anomaly and that Starfleet has basically named it a graviton ellipse. It travels through subspace, emerging occasionally without warning. Chakotay then mentions the Ares IV mission and its encounter.
There's a couple of moments in this scene where, because Bob is an actor, I think he allowed the actors to take moments of silence. And I noticed in this episode some off-camera looped lines that I'm sure Rick Berman was like, we can't have three seconds of silence. Have Janeway say something off camera here while Chakotay's having his dramatic walk forward.
Yeah.
And I noticed a pattern a little more in this episode, and I was wondering why. And then I thought, oh, it's probably Bob. It's because Bob allowed us, because he's an actor, he's a sensitive guy.
Yeah.
To him, that silent moment of Chakotay walking forward to be drawn to this thing was powerful, but to Rick Berman, it's just silence and somebody's got to be talking.
Well, I think if you look at those moments as they would exist in a movie, you would let them play, but television is a different kind of attention span.
Yeah.
And they should have been left to play, but like as you were describing that, I went, like, my mind was just cycling through all of these moments of Starfleet officers approaching view screen silently in awe of what they're seeing. And it was kind of undermined. There's
a few of them in here where I felt like you could hear the loop, the change in tone of the delivery of Janeway's line or whoever, you know, I heard quite a few of them in this episode. So it was just a little observation.
Chakotay mentions the Ares IV mission and its encounter with the graviton ellipse, which causes the mysterious disappearance of the Ares IV and astronaut Kelly. Janeway then decides to follow it and study it after Chakotay mentions that no one has been this close and lived to tell about it, and that this is a great opportunity.
Yeah, Chakotay, right? He says, this could be a remarkable opportunity.
Yeah.
And Brian, whenever a character in Star Trek in the Act One says, this could be a remarkable opportunity. We know we're in trouble.
Yeah.
I was like,
bad decision making is coming up.
Exactly.
Well, at least he doesn't dive head in. I mean, he says, let's launch a probe. You know, he doesn't say we're going to go right into it. So he has a little bit of caution there. Yes. Right. So we have an exterior shot of the anomaly traveling through space with Voyager following. And now we're in astrometrics with Tuvok and Seven. Seven says that she's receiving some telemetry from the probe. And the probe has entered a stable core within the anomaly, which Tuvok then says, the eye of the storm. Tuvok asks the computer to run a multi-spectral analysis of the anomaly's core. And Seven starts suggesting that we dissipate the anomaly from the inside by first, you know, taking a shuttle and altering the shields. So she's talking about, you know, getting rid of this anomaly. Tuvok doesn't agree. He thinks we should study it. The core analysis does come back showing that there are more than 2.8 billion compounds, including the synthetic alloys, titanium and polymer composites, which made up the hull of the Ares IV command capsule. So that is the most intriguing thing in this scene.
I would argue that there are other intriguing things happening in this scene.
Oh, please.
One of the things I love about this scene is Seven of Nine calling out Tuvok for, you know, not being logical with
being
as deadly, so it should be destroyed.
Correct.
And he's like, or it should be explored. And she's like, WTF, Tuvok.
Yeah.
You know, WTFT. And he's like, I'm still a Starfleet officer. I still explore. I still have fascination and curiosity. Logic does not negate curiosity.
Right.
And it's one of those, there's several scenes between Tuvok and Seven of Nine that I love, because you have two very dry characters, and whenever they can get into something that is about passion or you know, things that are outside of their logical exteriors, because Seven of Nine is, you know, fulfilling a kind of Vulcan role in the classic Star Trek sense of being the voice of reason and logic. And even here, she's met with the real voice of reason and logic on the ship, and he's saying, let's be curious. And that felt like there was a unique dynamic between Tuvok and Seven of Nine that made those types of scenes extra special.
I even felt it in an early line in the scene when Tuvok says, like the eye of a storm. And he uses sort of a poetic metaphor. In fact, I think Seven even comments, apt metaphor, something like that. But I was like, immediately I went, oh, that's interesting that Tuvok is taking a more kind of poetic
Yes.
Point of view.
Yes.
That's unexpected. When you see these two very logical, dry characters,
yeah,
it's an opportunity to kind of explore the nuances of Tuvok or the nuances. So I totally agree with you. I thought it was a very interesting scene. My question though, Brian, is, so we're in Astrometrics, we're getting data on this probe we sent. Why does it have to be in Astrometrics? Like, I know the scene was a nice little two-hander, but like, why does Astrometrics exist, I guess is what I'm getting at. Like, why can't we analyze this same data on the bridge with everybody being a part of it?
Oh,
or yeah. Was Astrometrics just a place to go do PowerPoint presentations that could have been done on the bridge anyway?
Well, I think the sensors are like, within the narrative, the sensors are, you know, much more acute in terms of their sensitivity. And also, when you're doing that kind of work on the bridge, you have Tom Paris saying, "I'm driving."
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Like, go do that in the back. Go
do that in the back. Okay. It's just sometimes it's interesting to me because we didn't have the Astrometrics lab for a long time. And then once Seven came on the show, now we've got this new set where a lot of things we do in Astrometrics, even when Janeway's there or other people there, we're like, oh, we used to do all that on the bridge, but now we've got this other place. It just, I guess it depends on if you want Tom Paris screaming, "I'm driving here," or not.
Don't make me turn around.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's a couple of reasons. And didn't Harry Kim initiate the Astrometrics and then Seven of Nine came along and they did it? They did it together.
Collaboration, that's right. Yeah. It's a collab between Harry. And I think that if you spent all that money on building that set, you might as well show it off.
It's a cool set. Not to
be cynical, but that's probably the main reason is that it's we're on the bridge for every other kind of conversation. Yeah. So let's find someplace else.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just, it's kind of like another bridge is kind of what I'm getting at. It's got a big view screen and a bunch of computers telling you stuff.
Right.
But well,
but it's a bridge with only usually two characters on it, basically.
It's a good place for two-handers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of like the bridge is the big TV and the Astrometrics is the screening room. So it depends on what you're watching. If you're going to watch reality TV, just do it on the bridge. If you're going to watch a movie, go to Astrometrics.
Go to the screening room, yes. Yeah. Okay. After another exterior space shot of the Graviton ellipse being followed by Voyager, we are now in the briefing room. Torres is up at the monitor describing this command capsule, 46 meters in length, 92 metric tons, powered by a third generation ion drive, equipped with a transspectral imager. Seven says that the Borg were working on shield enhancements to enter the anomaly. Tuvok says we've got about 16 hours before this anomaly re-enters subspace. Janeway wants to find what's left of Ares IV, so Harry and B'Elanna are assigned to help with shield enhancements. Tom is assigned to review the database from the Ares IV mission. Chakotay volunteers as the mission leader. Seven stays to express her concern about the danger involved.
She more than expresses concern. She's and Janeway
she's a buzzkill.
She is a buzzkill.
She really is.
She's very combative with Janeway in this scene. And Janeway, again, you know, raising this adolescent child that she is raising in Seven of Nine, you know, is very patient. And I thought, you know, the way she speaks to her and tries to explain that exploration is about seeing things with your own eyes. I love that idea. You know, it's not just probes and data.
Yeah.
It's about the connection of actually being there, which ties into speeches later on. It's a big theme in this of like, you know, was it worth us exploring space? John Kelly says, you know, this was worth it. So I love that idea. Janeway expresses that with Seven and kind of plants the seeds. And then she says, hey, maybe you should join the away team. She suggests that she volunteer for the first time. So.
She does. And I like her line when Janeway says that Seven never really appreciated human history. I mean, as a Borg drone, they basically assimilated all these people and got their histories, but not there was no appreciation of it. So she encourages her to volunteer. And she's not happy about it.
You know, there's something about, you know, Seven of Nine's assessment of humanity's curiosity and human history that being a Borg, you kind of want her to say, surprise, you're not the most interesting people in the galaxy.
Right.
So, you know, as opposed to like it being some sort of disconnect, you know, there's something about just an entitlement and point of view that could have been explored in that scene where, you know, Seven of Nine has met a lot of people and killed them eventually. And perhaps humans aren't the most interesting, which is why it took the Borg so long to get around to, you know, our neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting idea. Yeah. I don't know that I've heard that expressed in the show from Seven ever quite that succinctly.
Well, because it's sort of, you know, antithetical to what Star Trek is, which is like the human experience and how great we are going out into the world or, you know, the galaxy. And it is our point of view, but as we are learning, you know, through, you know, as so many different aspects of humanity are emerging, whether it's transness or gender fluidness or non-binariness, like one point of view isn't necessarily as unique as you would think. So that was also, I think, one thing that I wish we had leached out of this story of Seven or Nine, saying like, you know, it's important to you, but it might not be important enough to risk your lives.
Yeah. Very interesting point. I have a question, point of discussion about Borg. So I read that Borg maturation chambers accelerate maturation 25 times. 25 times natural acceleration is what a Borg maturation chamber. And Seven has said that she was raised after she was assimilated. She was raised in a maturation chamber. So if she was kidnapped, let's say it's 7 years old, I can't recall, but something like that, and put in a 25 times maturation chamber.
Yes.
To be an adult. Then she was really only assimilated maybe a year ago, 2 years ago.
So basically, right? She's nine is what you're saying.
Well, I'm saying like okay. in our human time,
yes.
she wasn't assimilated 20 years ago, 30,
yeah.
You know, she was assimilated not that long ago, which just kind of blew my mind as that I was thinking a lot. About.
Yeah, that's huge.
Any thoughts on that, Brian? Yeah. Did you guys ever discuss that?
Because the Raven and her assimilation, she was assimilated as a child. Like what? Like the Raven was 20 or 30 years before.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, keep going.
So I think the logic would be that she was assimilated, put in a maturation chamber, and you know accelerated, but then had been a Borg for
20 years.
Yeah, 15 or 20 years. So she'd been Borging for a while, but she was assimilated as a child. Then that's accelerated to her adult Borg form. And then, you know, so her childhood was basically compressed. So her adult experience as a Borg was longer.
Okay.
That helps my brain a little bit.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Create the deck of your dreams now at Menards. Spend less time maintaining your deck and more time enjoying it with UltraDeck low-maintenance composite decking from Menards. It's easy to install and built to last. Plus, get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on UltraDeck and check out more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. And I guess when they're Borg, when she was a Borg, do Borg die naturally? Do they age and die off, or do they, or does the Borg?
I imagine you have nanoprobes that are regenerating tissues and body function, system function, like, you know, on a pretty clear cycle that
so you could live forever theoretically almost live forever unless you're killed in a battle or something.
Yeah, I mean, Borg are, you know, cyborg zombies.
Yeah, right.
For lack of a better expression. So they are undead in a way, and or their systems are being kept up by a constant circulation of robots that are repairing any damage that, that might occur or cellular decay. Or-
so that makes sense. Now, I was just trying to wrap my head around her timeline.
Yeah.
That she was seven and then she skipped to be whatever she is basically now. And then was sort of frozen in time for 15, 20 years as a drone. And then when we restored her as much as we did, that she became her human body, started a new human timeline.
Right.
Okay, that helps a lot. Because I was I was just trying to wrap my head around like how her memory and how her human experience of aging had happened. You know, she experienced aging to seven, then she skipped it in the maturation chamber really fast. And then she sort of got frozen in time. Okay, that helps.
She kind of went from six to 25, you know, over a matter of a couple of months.
Right.
And then has been living at
25 this whole time.
Yeah,
for two decades. Okay.
That helps. Thank you for the sidebar, but it was but it was something like knowing that timeline helps the context of this story in a way.
Yeah.
You know, like being clear on it. And I don't know that I was ever clear on it, to be honest.
All right. We are now in Astrometrics, where we find Chakotay in Paris listening to the last transmission from astronaut Lieutenant John Kelly. Seven does arrive to comment on their hero worship and to announce that she is going on the mission since she is the best suited to monitor the Borg tech enhanced shields.
I loved her reading of her line when she was, I'll be joining you or something. She was so angry about it. It was great. It was great. Cherry did a great job.
Not happy to be doing
it. I also love this scene. I had forgotten that I was much a part of this episode, to be honest, until we watched it. I really didn't remember anything that other than Bob directed it. That's all I remember.
Yeah.
But watching it, I love this scene with Tom Paris and Chakotay because we don't often see them sort of bonding.
No.
In any way. They had conflict from the pilot. And so to see this sort of common ground that they're on and this kind of the romanticism and the authenticity of the scene, I thought was really nice. So it was something we rarely saw out of either one of them and much less together. It was great.
For me, obviously you can see with my office, I'm a collector and I have, you know, huge sentimental attraction to a lot of different things. And that was kind of the basis that we talked about with this scene, Michael and I, in terms of what were the sentimental attractions for both of these men that they were able to share kind of for the first time. So they're like, you like history, like I like history, but we just are focused on different facets of it. And that just felt like, these two guys probably would have more in common if they actually opened up to each other.
Yeah. I thought it was really well done and something we didn't normally see. So thank you. It was great.
Agreed. We are in sick bay and the doctor gives Seven a hypospray to counteract the effects of gravimetric radiation. He talks about one of his first away missions to Arrakis Prime, a little reference to the amazing Dune. He asks Seven to record images from inside the ellipse, and he talks about how materializing on Arrakis Prime was so exhilarating. And he says, one small step for a hologram and one giant leap for mankind, hence the title of this episode. And then Chakotay hails Seven to report to Shuttle Bay 2. Comments on this scene in sickbay?
It's an added scene, so the episode was short.
Oh.
And you have to remember those, like whenever it's like, okay, we need a two-page walk and talk, or we need a two-page. I think the scene originally was Seven, I've just brought the camera and has like a line reference. And then the episode was short. So it's like, well, let's have a scene where he hands the camera over.
Gotcha.
And so those scenes are always really, really tricky because they are not moving the story forward. They're just filling up time. So they have to be all about character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I thought it was great. It was nice to see Bob. I know he directed this episode, but he didn't have much more to do than this scene. He had very little. So
yeah,
it was nice to see the doctor and him doing his thing.
Yeah. And that probably helps, actually, right? I mean, Robbie, if you're not in it a lot and you're directing it, you can focus more on the directing than on your own work. So
yeah,
that's a good thing. Absolutely. We have exterior shot of the Delta Flyer leaving Voyager, heading towards the anomaly.
In that space shot, by the way, you see the Delta Flyer kind of show the belly, the underside.
Yes.
And you see these, it looks like shield enhancements or hull enhancements, these black portions. But I didn't see it the rest of the episode. Whenever I saw the Delta Flyer after that underside, I was like, where's the
shield enhancements?
Yeah, and then I was like, well, maybe it was shadows that I saw, but I don't know. But I felt like when I first saw this, I'm like, oh, there's the Borg shield enhancements that they were talking about installing. Yeah. But I never saw them again. This is the only time, so.
Huh.
I think that was probably, you know, using the standard model and then having one shot that had the add-ons.
Yeah, probably was a budget thing, but it was a little detail that I was like, oh, I wish we could attract that.
Yeah.
Paris is giving a countdown to the ellipse's perimeter. And on the Voyager bridge, we are monitoring the Delta Flyer, and we know that the shields have been weakened, but they are still holding. Janeway wants Harry to keep his finger on that tractor beam button just in case. We've lost sensor contact, but the comm link is still active. Inside the Delta Flyer interior, there's full thrusters to punch through the core. Chakotay reports that we are now inside the stable and calm eye of the storm. And on the bridge, everyone is listening to Chakotay's description. The EM activity has created this natural luminescence. They've detected asteroid fragments, pieces of vessels, matter from every quadrant in the galaxy, even a primitive atmosphere. Janeway asks Seven what she thinks. Seven says it's intriguing and that some of the matter is extra dimensional in origin. Harry responds, sounds like this anomaly's gotten around. So here's a little bit of humor now from Harry talking about how the anomaly is a little frivolous with its behavior, I guess.
Bloody anomalies are Harry's favorite kind of
I loved the execution of this whole thing as they, because once Chakotay says, punch us through, Tom, or something.
Yeah.
We kind of leave the shuttle and we just go to audio.
Yeah.
And we hear a lot of Chakotay's description. And Bob did a beautiful job on the bridge of this long oneer. Mm-hmm. It was the crane with the remote head moving around the bridge, capturing in the background the joke that Harry's got, capturing in the background B'Elanna, but it stayed on the reactions to what they were hearing and the anticipation and Janeway sort of picturing what Chakotay was describing. And I thought that was really wonderful to play it kind of off the dialogue and more on the reactions in such an elegant way. It was really well done.
Good job, Bob.
We talked about that scene being analogous to the Close Encounters scene early on in the movie when you're at the traffic control hubs and you don't see the aliens, you just hear people talking about it, and it being this shared experience where everybody back on the ship who also has an emotional attachment to whatever piece of histories that we find in the anomaly. I remember distinctively referencing the Close Encounters of the Third Kind scene where you're with people who only have audio and the special effect is their faces.
Right. Yeah, it was great. I love that was, again, intentional, a discussion about that reference. And it was really well done by the camera crew and Bob and everybody. I thought it was great.
After Harry's slutty anomaly joke, we are jolted by a gravimetric surge caused by the anomaly making a course correction of 0.006 degrees. There's only 5 hours and 36 minutes left before this anomaly will re-enter subspace. So they are going to go ahead and record data inside the core while trying to locate the Ares 4, which is definitely going to be a task since it's so vast inside there. We jump to the Delta Flyer interior, the aft compartment, where Seven and Chakotay are studying material that they've collected from inside the core. Chakotay talks about a rock that is billions of years older than Earth. And, you know, this is something that Seven seems quite not enthusiastic about. And basically, he says, you're now holding a piece of history after he tells her, grab this. And he says, paleontology was always his first love. Is this his first reference to this ever in the show, that he's this paleontologist enthusiast?
Well, history, he's definitely talked about history and cultural history. So
right.
They're it's been in there, but this is it. You're not wrong to be like, wait, this is new. Because we kind of got a little bit of that with Distant Origin.
And so we
knew that he was paleontological by training.
Right.
And we just hadn't talked about it in a while.
Yeah.
I think actually the last time we discussed it was Distant Origin.
Yes. And that's been quite a while. But he says this is why he joined Starfleet. And then he asks Seven what she wanted to be before she was assimilated. She hesitates, but then it comes out that she wanted to be a ballerina.
This is where I went, wait a minute. She remembers she wanted to be a ballerina. Let me track her timeline. This is where I was like,
this is it.
Yeah, this was the moment where I was like, when did she want to be a ballerina? And does she know that Janeway did the Dying Swan ballet in one of our episodes? Because that might bond them a bit.
That might.
Janeway and Seven doing some ballet on talent show night, I think would be amazing.
I wasn't a fan of the ballerina stuff.
Yeah.
That Seven wanted to be a ballerina?
Yeah, that was sort of like the gag of, isn't it funny that this Borg wanted to be something as delicate as a ballerina? And it felt like a lame joke for me.
Brian, if you had
that battle.
Okay, if you won that battle, what would you have filled in instead of ballerina?
I think there would be an interesting comment about, you know, I never had aspirations as a child because I was in a maturation chamber for 6 months, and then I was a 25-year-old drone.
Right.
So to have these aspirations is not how I think. And there's something about, once again, sort of human privilege that would have been interesting to explore there by just saying, no, because of my trauma, I was denied aspirations of such kind. I think there would have been a humor in shutting that shit down with, it's so funny that you didn't, like, you were violated as a child like me.
Right.
Tom interrupts on the comm that we are getting close to the Ares IV, but what I found interesting was that Tom uses the term heads up. And typically we don't use 20th century slang or colloquialisms. I mean, it's very interesting that we get to hear Tom say something a little out of his norm or out of the norm of how we normally do it. So was that something that you wrote on there? Or was that Michael writing heads up?
Like, felt like just everybody like, look. So is there a deeper sports reference that I was missing? Or?
No, I'm just saying it's just, Robbie, do you agree with me? I mean, Tom, you know,
I think Tom's one of the few that uses that kind of 20th century slang.
It does.
Or that's one thing I loved about Tom is everybody else would have the technobabble explanation of some phenomenon. And then he'd say, oh, it's like the, you know, shit hitting the fan, basically.
Right.
He'd just say, oh, what you're trying to say is it's like the shit's hitting the fan.
Right.
And I love that he would be able to say a version of that and speak kind of plain English for, you know, the everyman out there. And I think the audience is like that as well. So,
yeah, I agree. In the Delta Flyer cockpit, they come across an intact command module, and Chakotay essentially wants to tractor beam this thing back to Voyager. Now, on the bridge, Harry detects another course change of 0.003 degrees. Janeway says it's the third one in an hour and asks what could generate an EM field large enough to get its attention, but still not show up on sensors. B'Elanna says dark matter.
Wait, right here. So this is a moment. Oh, Brian, I wish. So, you know, when they do one of our early episodes for season one, it's famous now when Janeway and B'Elanna both are talking. Well, what if this and what if that? And they both simultaneously go, warp particles. This was a moment where I was like, because Janeway's up by Harry, and she's asking a question.
Harry answers a couple of things, right?
Harry answers, he's sandwiched in the middle, and then B'Elanna asks a question, and I wanted them both to go, dark matter! Oh, it would have been a great warp particles moment. But anyway, B'Elanna does it by herself. She has her aha moment of dark matter, and then they should have done that in unison, though.
They should have. Good call, Robbie. Good call. Yeah. I love that.
They scan for dark matter. B'Elanna finds a dark matter asteroid approaching in the distance, and Janeway calls over to the flyer and says, you guys got to get out of there now.
There's a problem.
We cut inside the flyer.
Yeah.
Chakotay is starting to really get obsessed here, and he's like, let's tractor it. tractor this thing back.
Right. But Janeway says there's no time, because he says that in the other scene. He's like, you know, I want to get this tractor tractor beam on there. And Janeway, there's no time. You got to get out. But he defies her orders.
He defies her orders. And he's angry. He's sort of like yelling this stuff. He's getting very passionate.
Obsessive is another description.
Yeah. Did you think that was earned from his character? Did that feel organic, or did it feel like, oh, like maybe he's hungry?
If I'm being honest, I felt a little bit Jekyll and Hyde here. Like he was kind of going to the dark side a little.
It was inconsistent. It was sort of like, do we buy that? It's one of our great frustrations when we're watching a horror movie and a character does something stupid and then results in them being in danger. And we're kind of in this same circumstance.
As they are trying to exit this anomaly, they are basically slowed down by this tractor beam, and just when they're at the perimeter about to get out, that's when the asteroid collides with the anomaly and knocks the Delta Flyers back. The tractor beam is dissolved. Chakotay gets electrocuted, I suppose, and he gets thrown on the ground. Plasma-cuted? Yeah, we could say that.
He gets plasma-cuted. And he kind of falls back from the panel and then hits the ground.
Yeah,
I have to say, it was a classic Shatner sort of fall. It was fall over. It's only on Star Trek can we get away with it, but yes.
It's like when you got shot in Prime Directive, if you remember that.
Oh, right? I did a jazz dive.
You did a jazz fall.
I did a total jazz fall.
It was the best. It was amazing. I loved it. Yeah,
Broadway.
Yeah, pretty much it. He has a severe concussion, internal injuries, communication, shields, propulsion offline. Shields are repairable, but the engine, forget about it. It's shot. And there is less than 2 hours before this anomaly enters subspace. Mm-hmm. Huge problem. Go to commercial, come back, back to the interior. Chakotay regains consciousness. And he's informed of this dire situation. And he keeps making these suggestions and commands.
Keeps trying to sit up. And Tom's like shoving him down. Like, sit down. I'm the doctor's orders. Yeah. I like that. I like my part of that scene. I liked. I like taking control. Shut up.
You got very firm with him, Robbie.
I mean, did.
You kind of.
Well, I started it, and then I went up to work on something in the front, and Seven took over.
Passed the baton to Seven, right? So Seven gives him the status report, and then lays into him almost harsher than Robbie did than Tom does for disobeying Janeway and causing their current predicament. And
who's she to be talking?
Because I saw the underside of the flyer and she didn't finish the shield modification.
They fell off. She like licked the bottoms and stuck them and then they hit an anomaly and they popped.
Yeah.
You know, saliva often can attach shield modifications quite well. So, oh my gosh. But Chakotay actually admits to his wrong choice. He apologizes. He feels like, oh, look, I put everyone in jeopardy. And she said, no, you put all our lives in jeopardy, basically. But it's nice to have Chakotay not argue about this.
He tries to make a joke, too. He says, you know, well, if we don't survive out here, somebody will come looking for us in a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
Exactly. What the hell?
Seven's like, no, not even funny at all. I love it.
This is sort of like the wobbliest part of the episode for me, is that Chakotay, who's usually the guy saying like, don't do this dangerous thing, is now doing this dangerous thing.
Yes.
And it's a little artificial.
Oh yeah, for sure. But we do get a transmission from Voyager. Voyager uses the probe to help as a relay, a transmission relay. And now we know what's going on. And we're in deep poop at this point.
One thing I wanted to say about, again, about Bob's direction is his panning shot game was very strong in this episode.
It was.
That his ability to kind of block things in a way where one character would speak, it would hand off to another, they'd bring it around to another. Mm-hmm. I wonder, because Brian, you said the episode was short, when you direct that way, when you don't build in editorial cuts, but you're sort of handing off shots without a cut, it's very elegant, but it locks you into the timing.
And generally that can be longer. And I think, you know, what we found, I think on the Star Trek shows, that they often were shorter when there wasn't time for cinema, when there weren't any kind of like moments of awe and those things weren't milked, is when we found ourselves short. And you know, like, I've learned so much in terms of what translates to page count and what doesn't. And like on Hannibal, our scripts for the same length of time were like 32 pages, 33 wow. pages, where Voyager, we were in the 50s.
Yeah, in 50s 60s. Or 60s, sometimes yeah. even 70s. I remember getting scripts, sometimes there were 72 pages. And a lot of times that was because on Star Trek, we would have to give a new scene number to every visual effects shot.
Yeah.
So if there was a they beam in, that had its own scene number, which added page count, because often in scripts that I work with now, those kind of vis effects are just buried in the description or right. an action line. They don't have an entire scene number dedicated to them. But that's what, for budget purposes on Star Trek, that's what was asked, as I recall, of you, of the writers, is if it was a beam in, if it was a space shot, if it was any vis effects shot, that have its own scene number, even though it continued the action to the next scene, it would make the scripts much longer. So
they no longer became accurate representations of any sort of timing. Because
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
There's a race now. There's a race to solve this problem of lack of power. And Kim suggests, well, we could do the same type of shielding on a class two shuttle, take it in. Paris says, well, that took us hours to make the original mm-hmm. modifications. This is no good.
Tuvok says we could tractor beam them.
Harry says it's you couldn't get this tractor beam all the way through to the core. Janeway mm-hmm. says, we'll just start working on it anyway.
Then Torres yes. thinks of plasma manifolds.
She does.
She thinks if they're fused, they could be fused and preventing it from moving on its own power. Seven confirms this. And the new manifolds can't be created as the replicators aren't working on the flyer. Mm-hmm. So then Torres points out, she says, wait a minute, Ares 4 had the same device that called the ion distributor.
Right.
And she said, maybe this Ares 4 thing, the ion distributor, could be modified to channel our warp plasma.
Mm-hmm.
And Seven's like, yeah, well, if we can find it. And everybody agrees that that's worth a try. Let's find this ion distributor. Mm-hmm. So Janeway asks if there's enough power for transporting. Paris volunteers to go, but Janeway says, no, you stay on the flyer and be there in case another gravimetric surge hits. We need you, your piloting skills. So Janeway says, ask Seven. And I love that Seven again says, oh, Captain, are you encouraging me to volunteer again? Which I thought, I literally laughed out loud, Brian, yeah. when she said that. Because I love a good runner. So
there you go.
It was great.
It's the comedy.
It's the yeah. comedy and the callbacks. It's the classic. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Then we see Seven in a spacesuit, mm-hmm. Which I'm very familiar with. I remember wearing that a few times. Mm-hmm. A so long episode floating around in space with B'Elanna as we yeah. almost died.
Mm-hmm.
Those spacesuits were so uncomfortable.
They were the worst
because they sort of sat on your shoulders and yeah. they were this molded plastic. So any kind of movement, it would dig in your rib cage.
Yeah.
And then they had fans on the inside to keep them right. from fogging up. So you couldn't hear anybody.
I wonder, Robbie, how many of those spacesuits did they have? Because I really felt like there were only maybe two or three total.
They didn't have. Yeah.
They were from First Contact.
Yeah, they were all those adapted from First Contact.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
She's in the spacesuit and Chakotay's jealous, he says, as she's getting yeah. ready. He's very jealous yeah. that she gets to go.
Well, and this is sort of like an interesting metaphor for Seven's introduction to the show, is that even when it is a Chakotay story, Seven of Nine's going to come along and take it away from you. And it's thematically and narratively sound, and it works because of Seven of Nine's arc, but it's hard to deny the overwhelming commonplace of Seven of Nine taking stories away from other characters.
Yes. But yes. When, you know, Brian, it's funny because I always talk about seasons 5, 6, and 7 is the Janeway Dr. Seven show at that point. It's yeah. like, it's like so focused on those three characters, but you're right. She totally snags away the touchdown rush, the rush for the touchdown.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, so I've learned in this podcast that you say this was could have been a Tom Paris episode, but then it became a Chakotay episode.
Yeah.
And it could have been a Chakotay episode,
but then it became a seven episode.
It's interesting how all that sort of evolved.
You know, I think it's sound for Seven of Nine's character.
Absolutely.
But Chakotay's character growth just stops. Like, sort yeah. of, he's going here. He sort of behaves a little inconsistently. Yeah. And then he checks out. and somebody else finishes his arc, I can see why there would be frustration.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed. Oh, yeah. So we go over to the Ares IV next.
Yeah.
And Seven does beam in.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed on her beam in, as she comes into this old NASA vehicle, the music, there was a nod to the original series as she comes in.
Oh.
You hear a little theme of the original Star Trek series. And I love that. And I wonder, I caught it there, but I wonder if there was more of that from the composer. I thought it was really smart and clever.
There's little touches. Is it Max Steinberg who did a lot of the original music? There's little touches that, I'm blanking on our composer. We had two different ones, but one primary, right?
Yeah, we had three sometimes. I don't know who did this episode, but I did catch that. That little nod, Dennis McCarthy. I caught that little nod to it. It didn't complete the phrase of the original theme, but it started the phrase. You had a little bit of it there. And I thought for this episode, for us going back to NASA, the inspiration for our Voyager characters and using what probably inspired Gene Roddenberry, the space race of the 50s and 60s, the NASA that was in the culture back then, putting all those things together with that little musical theme, I thought was very, very smart, mm-hmm. especially in that moment that she just comes into this Ares IV NASA spaceship. It was great. Just a little detail.
Yeah.
I love the Dutch angles and the floating camera again. We're back to, no gravity on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I loved how Jerry was walking with the mag boots that mm-hmm. she had to walk with. She really sold all of that. There was a floating flashlight that came through that she pushed out of the way.
Mm.
Thought that was great. Yeah. I also love the fact that we never saw John Kelly's fully mummified body, that we only saw
his hand. Yeah.
And it kept it from going into a horror genre and more to Seven's experience of what we're not seeing, but what we know she is seeing.
Yeah. So as she's trying to retrieve this ion distributor, she comes across some log entries, and these are the final log entries, or all the final log entries of Kelly. And I like seeing those log entries because you do see the sort of progression of him going from having all his wits about him until the last moments of his life. So it's quite sad, to be honest. But what I got pulled out when it Bob cut to a reaction shot of Seven kind of like looking back at him. And I didn't think that was necessary. I think that pulled me out. I didn't like that. So that's the only criticism I have of the entire episode is that one point right there. I didn't like
that. I thought there was such great transitions in this sequence that he went off of kind of a light flare at one point.
Mm.
Bob went off of we're with Seven and the camera sort of went into a light that flared the camera out. And all of a sudden we were in the flashback with John Kelly.
Yeah.
And then off of John Kelly, as he moved, floated through the cockpit into a bulkhead or something, and then came out of the bulkhead into Seven. So I felt like the way he photographed it, he and Marvin Rush, it started bringing the past and the present together in a visual way that I thought was really smart.
No, I'm not arguing with those transitions. I agree with you 1,000%. I'm saying later on, after we're listening to the log entries, towards the end of the log entries, there's a point where you're really engrossed in what's happening with Kelly. And then all of a sudden you're pulled out of it by this very awkward shot of Seven sort of like looking back at the screen and still trying to work. And it was like, I don't know if that, maybe the direction of her business could have been different. Maybe if it was just her kind of working and then just looking up for a second instead of like awkwardly. I mean, because that whole suit, you can tell she's uncomfortable in it too. Awkward. You know, your physicality is completely messed up wearing those damn suits. So,
love in story-wise in here that we realized that Kelly survived this, that he actually was able to experience being inside this anomaly for a while, which we didn't know from the teaser. We just knew that the thing hit him.
But here's the weird thing. How did he survive? Because we talk about how in the beginning, as this anomaly is about to overtake us, Harry says, this is going to rip our shields off. This is going to rip our plating off once we go through. So I feel like he should have been killed immediately, right? When he went through, but somehow maybe he was shielded by some other debris or something where he made it through. But it just, that to me didn't add up a little bit. So
the science,
it's also the size of the ship. was
true.
Guys, and that's Voyager, true. And why yes. the Delta Flyer, yes. being a smaller ship, was able to penetrate yes. the anomaly and without being destroyed like a larger ship.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. That helps me. Thank you.
And I think the shot of seven that you're talking about is like was editorial, so it's probably not a decision that Bob made.
Okay.
I will agree to disagree on this. I actually liked that moment because when it came off the hand, because she sort of gets lost in these log entries and feeling connected to it. And then it's the moment of remembering that, oh, I'm not back there. I'm here. And he's a mummy. And I did like that moment because it was a reminder to Seven in the audience that that's nostalgic history. And this is very moving and emotional to experience.
Yeah.
But the reality is I've got this man who had this tragic end, his mummified body right in front of me. So I actually liked that shot.
I think my favorite moment really was her attaching the comm badge onto his body and saying, let's beam this over. Let's not leave him out here. Let's give him a proper burial.
Well, she doesn't even say that to anyone. She just says, lock on to my bio. What does she say? My bio signature and my comm badge, which is a strange way to ask for a beam out. But she doesn't have time to explain. So she just says, lock onto my bio signature and my comm badge.
Yeah. Whose idea was it, Brian, to sort of, in John Kelly's last log entries, towards the very end, the last couple of them, now he starts referencing, like he'll say, you know, he's talking to the other, you know, to Mission Control, but he's also talking to his dad, you know, so that was something that I thought was interesting.
Well, it was just the idea that I don't know if these messages are ever going to be received by the people that they're intended for. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to put them out into the ether.
Yeah.
And that the kind of tragedy of those last moments when you are by yourself and you don't know. So you just have to have faith that, like, by putting it out into the universe, that it will find its way. Yeah. And if it doesn't, then you got to express yourself, even if it wasn't a vacuum.
Yeah.
I love the way that in these last moments that you were able to so efficiently touch on some really big ideas. Like when he apologizes to Kumagawa that, you know, she claims she saw something over the Gulf and he was so dismissive and he regrets it. You know, that's a big idea.
That's
and
right.
You were able to very efficiently touch on dismissing the mysteries of things we don't understand or don't know. And he's admitting that he could have been wrong about that.
He was seven of nine in that moment. You know, was sort of like his monologue had to be servicing seven of nine's emotional journey at that point. Mm-hmm. So it's just as much of what John Kelly is saying as a character, as the storytellers are saying about seven of nine's journey in terms of, I'm sorry, I dismissed your passions. I'm sorry, I dismissed whatever observations that you had. And now that I'm living in your shoes, I have a greater understanding of your experience. And that felt like it was the best way to sort of land the plane on seven of nine's arc since she stole it from Chakotay. So now seven of nine's and also has a more satisfying through line because seven of nine, I would argue is authentic throughout as seven of nine and Chakotay is inconsistent with his character. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good that it landed on seven of nine because she was being consistent unlike Chakotay.
Yeah, agreed.
And I did completely forget about that one part with Lieutenant Kelly seeing the piece of the alien spacecraft hull that floats by, which was a very goosebumpy moment. It's like, there you go. There is life outside of Earth. So yeah, I did forget about that. So that was a good moment for sure.
So, all right. So Seven gets beamed over and Kelly's body gets beamed over. Seven, once she's beamed back on board, we see her rushing into the cockpit with the manifold. Paris and Seven quickly try to install it. They get it kind of working, but it's fluctuating power. He lays in a course out of the ellipse back on the bridge. Janeway and everyone are watching as the ellipse seems to start to melt. So it's going back into subspace. Mm-hmm. Seven continues trying to adapt this part, this distributor, and Paris says, okay, we're almost ready, open the shuttle bay doors. He's very confident. Then on the flyer, we see these sparks as they're trying to make their way out of this, their situation. And on the bridge, I love that Janeway We cut back to the bridge, and Janeway orders Voyager closer mm-hmm. to the edge to try to help them. Mm-hmm. And Torres is manning the helm. I've never seen B'Elanna flying the ship, but there's B'Elanna down. And I was like, oh, that's kind of nice. Maybe that means that she and Tom have spent some time talking about navigating, or because this is probably a tricky maneuver. It was just surprising to see B'Elanna at the helm getting so close to such a dangerous situation, but they're trying to get close, tractor them in.
Or Janeway is just trying to give B'Elanna a little bit of experience just in case Tom eats it on this mission. So yeah. she can take over his position. That's what it was.
That seat comfortable?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that feel? Does it feel okay? All right.
But they do get dangerously close, and Tuvok succeeds in getting this tractor beam locked on, which is the shuttle's just below the ellipse's surface, but they get the tractor beam through because they've gotten close. Janeway immediately orders a full reverse, mm-hmm. and they struggle to pull it out of the ellipse. And just as they pull it out and tow it out, we see it go back into subspace. Boy, that was close, Brian. You guys.
It was like giving birth. Wow. It was just pulling this baby out of the womb right there.
Yes.
And it worked.
I did appreciate Bob giving Seven and Tom one of those panning shots. It was about the biggest close-up of Tom Paris I've ever seen. So thank you, Bob, for that nice, very flattering close-up.
He sprinkled in close-ups throughout this episode, I've noticed.
He did, which I love. I love that there's a variety. We're not stuck in kind of these medium sizes that all feel the same. He did a great job.
Agreed.
We go to the bridge. We are having a funeral for Kelly there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's giving a very inspiring speech. I couldn't pay attention because my uniform looked less than flattering, let's say. I don't know why.
Is that what you were obsessing on in the last part of this episode?
I needed to do sit-ups, or they needed to tailor that a little differently or something. The pants were baggy and looked like dad jeans. I don't know. I was like, what am I wearing?
Wait, aren't we wearing formal dress uniforms at the end?
Mine was not fitted very well. Maybe I skipped the fitting. I don't know. But I was like, that is not a good look.
Oh my God.
But anyway.
Wow.
But Janeway's speech was very inspiring, I'm sure. I couldn't pay attention to it, but I'm sure it was. And then Seven asks to speak. And she starts to speak and gives her inspiring speech. But we cut to sickbay where Chakotay is listening. And I love, we kind of come back, even though Seven stole his story.
Yeah.
We do have a moment of closure for Chakotay there, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And both Janeway and Seven talk about the importance of exploration and about the human experience. And I thought that was beautifully written words, Brian. Really great.
Yeah. And ending with Seven's little comment of the Yankees in six games. Yeah, that private little
whisper to the coffin there.
Yeah.
Yankees in six games. And then a close-up of Pablo. Blowing his whistle.
Pablo blowing the bosun's whistle. Yes, that's Pablo Soriano, our eternal background actor. Yes, that was a nice ending right there.
Yeah.
So here's a question: What the heck, Brian, happens to these coffin photon torpedo coffins? What happens to that? You shoot it out in space, and is it in a direction back towards Earth, or what's happening? What does it do?
It's littering, honestly.
It's littering.
It is littering, isn't it?
It's an interesting kind of thing because you're sort of like formally letting go of a body.
Yeah.
So it is all just for the pomp and circumstance of the gesture. And so it's hard to think like, what's the goal beyond letting go?
Yeah. I think it is the pomp and circumstance. It is.
There should be some episode of Star Trek where they just keep on bumping into coffins.
That's my point. Like, there should be thousands, hundreds of thousands of Starfleet photon torpedo coffins that are just floating in space randomly. Especially, you know, after like a battle.
Blowing
like
out Wolf nacelles. 359.
Yes.
And deflector dishes. And like, what the hell?
It's sort of like how, you know, modern day airline pilots have to avoid flocks of geese. beliefs from ruin. Now, you know, Starfleet helmsmen have to avoid flocks of photon torpedo casings of human bodies that are now disposed of.
I want to see the gravity sequence where with all the space debris, but it's just coffins and body parts like slamming into space stations, and they're like, Jesus.
Oh my goodness. Horrible. Okay, so it doesn't evaporate or vaporize or anything like that.
No,
it
just stays just intact.
It just litters.
Just littering.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Good well, there you go. There's our episode. My theme is just to appreciate the value of the past and how your life is what it is because of the people before us. That was my theme. Appreciating the people that came before, our ancestors, like our all of it.
I like
that. What about you, Garrett?
I think it's a caveat. I think the lesson is a caveat, which is, you know, try not to be so obsessive that you're myopic to the point where you don't even see the big picture, which is kind of what Chakotay did and caused all the issues. But without him doing that, we wouldn't have an episode. So it's important that sometimes people lose it. So I think that's my theme, is just careful about becoming too obsessive. Okay. And let's go to our writer.
What's your
Star Trek lesson?
Well, there's something about the exploration of humanity as explorers that feels particularly resonant in this episode, because we're seeing a wide variety of characters and their relationship to not even the past, but their own sentimentality that has to be confronted in ways of like, why are you searching out the past? Are you searching out for validation? Are you searching out for education? Are you searching the past for some link to the future? And Seven of Nine cuts through all of those different motivations for exploring the past and amalgamates them and assimilates them in a way that is uniquely Borg. She assimilates everybody else's journey of exploration and relationship to exploration and homogenizes them into her own point of view, which feels like that's the best of the Borg.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Yeah, so you are validating that Seven of Nine stole this episode from Chakotay.
Yes.
Is that the lesson?
He was like, look that way, and went, yoink.
Okay, next we have our Admiral and Captain's ratings. They're averaged out from all of our Admiral and Captains. But so, first we give our ratings,
yes,
Brian. So I'm going to give this episode, this one is tough for me. Because there's a lot of things about it I like, but it doesn't feel like it starts to take off and then it just doesn't for me. It doesn't add, and maybe it's because Seven of Nine steals the episode from Chakotay. Maybe that's why. Maybe because it seems to change course midway.
What's your number?
It's focused, but I'm going to give you my number. It's well executed. There's well executed by Bob. Some great writing in it. I love some of the ideas, the inspiring ideas that all the characters have throughout. So there's a lot of good in it, but I still ultimately didn't quite take off for me. I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Oh, good.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
7. All right.
Out of 10.
Yes. I am going to give, I'm going to boost it up a little bit more. I'm going to give it 7.8 because of Phil Morris's involvement. So I'm going to give it a little bit more. Yeah. 7.8.
Okay. Brian,
I'm going to bump it up just a bit more with 8, I think, because of its character inconsistencies. It's a little wobbly in the narrative, but I think it goes to the heart of a lot of the thematics of Star Trek much more explicitly than we generally use, because they're kind of obfuscated in a puzzle box or a science fiction mystery. And this is really going to the heart of why we explore. And I feel like that makes it aspirational in a way that, you know, covers a lot of the kind of character inconsistencies that we have in the story, but still makes it a solid entry into Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. 75788. Our captain and admiral average rating for One Small Step is 7.8. Garrett,
I have been nailing these, Robbie. You know, I've been dang close, within 0.1 or dead on. Look,
unbelievable.
At that. Thank you. I feel so good right now.
Wow. All right. Validated. So we were all validated with that number, I think. We were very close.
We were.
Wow. All right. Well, Brian, thank you so much for recapping with us here. And it's always a pleasure, more than a pleasure, to have you on. It's fun and learn a lot. And it's great to see you. So thank you.
Well, great to see you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for the cozy t-shirt.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. And so thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And once again, thank you to Brian. And please join Robbie and I next week when we review, recap, and discuss the Voyager episode, The Voyager Conspiracy. Probably the only episode with the name Voyager within the title. Oh, so, yes, The Voyager Conspiracy. All right, everyone. Thanks again. And for all of the Patreon patrons, please stay tuned.